Now, as the economy struggles to find its footing, he's back. The world-renowned forecaster sets his sights on one key question. What is the new normal? Welcome back, the ever-insightful economist, Don Reynolds.
You've invited me back. Suckers! I've had a great year. My wife and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary this year. Thank you. I happen to also have a very precocious 14-year-old daughter. In the evening of which my wife went out to celebrate our 25th, we'd both gotten dressed up. And my wife looked at my daughter and said, "How do I look?" And my daughter said, Mom, you're over 50. Nobody cares." After I got my wife's fingers off her throat, I'm also blessed with a 22-year-old who's graduating from college in 4 years this spring. If anybody's got a job for him, give me a call. You get lifetime investment advice. He's got a great story. After he woke up after 2 years of majoring in beer and decided to become a student. I really enjoy your industry. I really like studying your industry. And unlike 2 years ago, where I was very negative about the future, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm very positive about the future. I'm positive about your industry. Mr. Jobs said, "Do not give up." I'm going to echo that theme because I really feel strongly that the U.S. economy is in a part of recovery, and there's a disconnect going on. 90% of economists will tell you we're in recovery, and 80% of consumers will tell you we're not in recovery yet. Because the consumer simply looks at the unemployment rate and says, as long as the unemployment rate is up by 10%, we've got trouble. Now, I'm going to tell you an interesting statistic. The unemployment rate is not 10%. That's the official unemployment rate. The unofficial unemployment rate, which includes people who have quit looking for a job, people who are underemployed or want to work more, is closer to 17%. That's a scary thought. And yet, I look at the hard data, and you have to understand the economic forecasting business. God created economists for one reason and one reason alone. There had to be an occupation that made astrology look respectable. And you see, I do not fixate on today's headlines. I fixate on what I believe the headlines are going to be 6 months, 9 months, 1 year from today. And that's what economists try and do. We try and look at the headlines of what we believe the future is going to be. And so you look at today's headlines and say, gee, things don't look too good. But I'm looking at the headlines you're going to see by the end of the year. And I'm going to tell you things are starting to look very good indeed. Let me sort of walk you through some of the reasons why. Because in effect, I'm going to give you a calendar type of forecast, which in essence says, I'm pretty bullish near term. It's the long term, the out years that bother me a bit more. And when we look at the current economic environment, what's not getting the headlines is corporate earnings are up by 35%. 65% of the companies on Wall Street have come out with better than expected earnings. Of the stimulus bill, you remember the stimulus bill that was passed a year ago, the $800 billion stimulus bill. Of that $800 billion stimulus bill, only 22% has been spent already. And you have to understand that when a dollar's worth of stimulus is spent, it takes 6 months to 9 months before it has an impact on the economy, which means you've still got a lot of positive stimulus getting ready to hit this economy. And the net result is that you've got more growth ahead. Somebody once said, you know, when is the recession going to be over with? And the answer was when the consumer thinks it's over with. And that's not doublespeak, because a lot of it's dependent upon consumer psychology, and the consumer looks around and says, gee, housing prices are down, unemployment is up, we hear a lot about budget deficits, there's massive political unrest in the country, we hear rumors of defaults in Europe, we don't like the picture. when we take a look at those trends, at those numbers, understand we took an enormous hit. I don't deny that. We effectively sucked $30 trillion out of this economy. Please walk with me through the numbers. If the residential real estate market goes from a $20 trillion equity market to a $14 trillion equity market, we've effectively taken $6 trillion out of the economy, all right? If the stock market, which is still 30% below its high, has gone from effectively 14,000 to 10,000 where it sits today, we've taken another $4 trillion out of the economy. The banking sector by itself took a $2 trillion hit, but it's in the banking sector that the numbers get very interesting. Anybody in the room serve on the bank board? A couple hands go up. The banking industry works off of a concept called capitalization ratio, and what the capitalization ratio simply says is for every dollar's worth of assets, you can loan $10. So if you take $2 trillion out of the banking sector, did you just wipe out $20 trillion worth of lending capability? And that's what we've done. Now, you've probably heard some speculation in the news media. It goes like this. Are we in a V-shaped recovery, down quickly, back up quickly? Are we in a U-shaped recovery, go down, stay down, start to come back up? Are we in a W-shaped recovery, which is sometimes called the second shoe to drop, or the idea that we've got another round of bad news coming, so you go down, you come up a little bit, you go down again, and then you come back up? And I look at those, and I once said, gee, it sounds like a Volkswagen recovery, it's a Vienna W. And I'm going to tell you what the recovery actually looks like. It's shaped a little bit like a square root. For those of you who don't remember your introductory math courses, a square root goes down, starts to come back up, and then when it gets about three-quarters of the way back up, it stops going back up and starts to gently trend up. And I think that's where we're at. Mohammed Alarian of PIMCO Resources coined a term called the new reality or the new normal, and in it he suggested the following, that the economy is entering a new period, a new era. For those of you who are sitting back and saying, gee, I just want things to get back to normal. I just want to get things to get back to where they were. It's going to be a long wait. He says the new normal is characterized by the following. Higher rate of inflation. It's coming. Higher interest rates. They're coming. Lower consumer spending on a long-term basis. We're there. A declining value of the American dollar. We've seen that. We've seen a recent rally, but I think the dollar again resumes weakness shortly. We are looking at a period that's punctuated by the fact that the United States is no longer the dominant economic superpower that it once was. Understand that in 2000, the United States was responsible for 28% of global economic output. Today, it's responsible for 20% of the global economic output. Understand also that three countries, China, India, and Brazil, are now worth 20% of global economic output, which is the same as we are, and basically suggests that the overall standard of living for the United States is not going to grow as rapidly, if not grow at all. You want to hear some good news? Oh, okay. I signed up at Geico yesterday and saved a bundle. Let's begin. See, the core to my analysis of near-term and long-term involves what we call the twin deficits. The twin deficits are the federal budget deficit, and what doesn't get a lot of talk, but I focus on intently, is the trade deficit. Let me explain by which I mean. If you look around the world today and you take a quick trip and you say, where are the U.S. dollars outside the United States? You say, well, gee, the Chinese have $1 trillion U.S. dollars. The Japanese have $600 billion U.S. dollars. The Taiwanese have $200 billion U.S. dollars. The Koreans have $250 billion U.S. dollars. The Europeans have $600 billion U.S. dollars. OPEC, or at the very least the Middle East, has another $1 trillion U.S. dollars. And you start to add up all those dollars. And you find out there's $5 trillion U.S. dollars outside of the United States. And we have a trade deficit today, fueled in large part by our import of fuel, of oil, that's running at $800 billion a year. So we're now growing our trade deficit, which is at $5 trillion, is going to grow by $800 billion a year. And you look at the Chinese, and the Chinese are sitting on all these American dollars. And of course, you understand how the global economy used to work. The global economy used to work this way. The Chinese and the Asians would agree to make cheap stuff. And we in the United States would agree to borrow money from our home equity loans and from our credit cards to buy their cheap stuff. They, in turn, agreed to take those dollars, invest them in our treasury bills to keep our interest rates low so we could afford to borrow more money to buy more cheap stuff. I'm serious. That's the way it worked. Until about 2 years ago, when we found out the price of residential real estate did not go straight up forever. It was interesting when they brought up the heads of the six largest consumer banks in front of Congress 3 weeks ago, and they were asking them about the debacle that had happened in the banking industry and about the fact that they were making loans in all these residential real estate properties. And it was astonishing to hear, they said, what type of computer modeling did you do if residential real estate prices dropped 30%? And they all said, we didn't do computer modeling at a decline of 30%. In fact, we didn't do computer modeling of any decline whatsoever. It is small wonder that the disaster occurred that did occur. Now, take a look at the components of that disaster. When I look at residential real estate, and we use in the residential real estate a concept called the affordability index, and the affordability index simply says this, is historically, and at least when I grew up, I was told that you should never buy a house that costs more than three times your annual income. Well, at the top of the market, some places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, and San Diego, the average home was selling at eight times annual income. Think about that. The average home in the United States was selling at six times annual income. Well, we've seen the prices correct significantly. As a matter of fact, now because of the slowdown in the economy and the decline of residential real estate values, the affordability index has dropped from 6 to 3.6. Is that getting pretty close to 3? Is that getting pretty close to where it should be? And so I'm going to tell you that I think we're getting very close to a bottom in the residential real estate market. I think that's good news. If you take a look at the banking system and recognize the banking system lost $2 trillion, they've started to replace it. I remember a year ago watching Ben Bernanke on 60 Minutes. And Bernanke was asked the question of when will you know that the banking sector has recovered, and his comment was very salient. What he said was the banking sector will recover when the banking sector can raise equity on its own. Guess what? In the last 4 months, that banking sector has done exactly that. Notice all that TARP money. Remember the Toxic Asset Relief Program? All that TARP money. Of the $500 billion in TARP, notice there were $700 billion in TARP, or $800 billion in TARP, excuse me, $740 billion in TARP voted on. They only spent $520, and of that $520, $200 billion has been paid back, and it's been paid back to the U.S. Treasury to the tune of a $42 billion profit. But we don't talk about that part of the equation. And so the banking industry has been able to recapitalize itself. And they're back to the 10 to 1. They've got their assets and their loans pretty much back to where they were. Now, admittedly so, they're sort of caught because the politicians are saying you've got to make loans to help stimulate the economy, and the regulators are saying never again. The old rule was 10 to 1. The new rule is 8 to 1. And they're still getting there. What's amazing is you pull the Federation of Independent Business in America and you ask them about their problems getting loans, and the response is their problem getting loans is number five on their list. Now, maybe it's because they don't want to borrow money because they're uncertain of what's going to happen, but I'm going to submit to you that the banks have got the cash and are looking at loaning money again. And you sit back and say, okay, Housing is bottoming. The banking sector has bottomed. That's good news. Corporate earnings are up. That's good news. The inflation rate is almost zero. That's good news. And you sit back and you see, I do an enormous amount of research, and people say, well, how do you do that research? How do you come up with these crazy predictions like I did a couple of years ago when I told you how rotten things were going to get? I taught graduate school for a while, and I'm going to tell you right now that graduate school is the last place in the world where slave labor is still legal. So I assigned my graduate students the following research project. You see, I live here, by the way. Welcome to North Texas. I live here in Fort Worth. By the way, we have a motto in Fort Worth. Fort Worth is where the West begins, and Dallas is where the East peters out. But I take a look and see this evolving story. And there are still some problems on the horizon. I want to talk about the other part of the twin deficit for a moment. I want to talk about what has been going on with the financial services industry. September 17th of 2008, Wall Street died as we conventionally knew it. That was the weekend that Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke called the heads of the 10 largest financial institutions of the United States into a single room. And it's interesting, ladies and gentlemen, how history repeats itself. Go back to 1929 when the great stock market crash occurs. And then the richest man in America, John Pierpont Morgan, summons the heads of the 30 largest banks in the country into a room at the Waldorf Astoria. Now, one of the reasons that J.P. Morgan or John Pierpont Morgan was the richest man in America after the crash, and it's one of the, and it dovetails with my theory of research and graduate students, is he decided to sell when his shoeshine boy was giving him stock tips. And it's reminiscent of a few years ago. My wife and I were walking through a Dillard department store. My wife, by the way, used to be a store manager for Dillard's. And one of the cosmetologists came up to me, and she wanted to talk to me about this new wonder drug. It was Viagra, which I think she meant Viagra. And it was made by a company called Pfizer, which I think we call Pfizer. And she wanted to know if she should buy it. And I said to myself, this has got to be the last person in America that knows about this. And 2 days later, I sold all my Pfizer because I'd already tripled my money. And sure enough, it was at the top of the market. So there's this contrarian viewpoint of what the public says. And so I assigned my graduate students to this research project. And what it simply said was this. I want you to go back 40 years in history and examine the front covers of the leading publications in America in terms of Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, Barron's. And I want you to analyze the headlines of those particular publications and correlate those headlines with the performance of the stock market. And guess what we found out? That there was a 20% inverse correlation. Translation is when the cover of Business Week magazine read, "How high can stocks go?" it was probably a good time to sell. And when the cover of Business Week said, "How low is low?" it was probably a good time to buy. I've got to be careful because I'm suggesting that the media always gets it wrong, and I've got a press conference after the speech. So I look at what I'm not reading. I look at the footnotes and I from literally 100 different information sources. And when I do that, it helps me get a clearer long-term picture. So we go back to the fateful weekend of September 17th and the echo of 1929. In 1929, J. Brent Morgan goes around the room and he says, "I've got the three largest banks in the country. I'm the richest man in the country." And he goes, "Your bank is going to merge with his bank. Your bank's going to go out of business and your bank is going to succeed because I personally am going to put money into it." And he tries to reorganize Wall Street. Flash forward to September 17th, a year and a half ago. And Bernanke and Paulson are sitting in the room with the 10 largest bankers in the room and says, we've got TARP money. Here's $350 billion. And proceeds to go around the room and says, you're going to take Bank America, you're going to take $25 billion. And Goldman Sachs, you're going to take $25 billion. And Citibank, you're going to take $50 billion. And Bank America, you're going to take $50 billion. And he goes around the room. They dole out $350 billion. Isn't that interesting? And that's the weekend so much occurs. That's the week. You remember Lehman Brothers? Lehman Brothers went under. That was the weekend Lehman Brothers went under. Understand, please, the chairman of the board of Lehman had three chances to sell out and still make money. And he declines all three chances. Now, in hindsight, we probably didn't need to let Lehman go under. But, you know, I've got this feeling that if I throw a man a life preserver three times and he doesn't take it, shouldn't I let him drown? That's the weekend that Wachovia sells itself to Wells Fargo. That's the weekend that Merrill Lynch gets sold to Bank America. That's the weekend that Morgan Stanley sells 20% of itself to the Japanese, not realizing that in another 6 weeks it was going to get to buy the Smith Barney unit from Citibank. And Goldman Sachs, the big daddy of them all, decides that weekend to convert themselves from an investment banking house to a bank. And that very next Monday morning, the biggest, most powerful financial services company in the country, Goldman Sachs, goes hat in hand to a man called the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, and proceeds to borrow $5 billion at 10% interest for 5 years. Gee, the world has changed a lot. And recovery is coming. In fact, I think that as I look at my crystal ball, I'm going to sort of stick my neck out here and tell you that I think I'm looking for upside surprises. Not only do I think we could see 2% real economic growth or 3% real economic growth, I think there's a chance by the fourth quarter we could be running as high as 5%. Now, that's called an upside surprise. I think that, yes, there are elections coming. And, you know, you can say what you want about President Obama, whether or not you're for him or against him, but I think we'd all agree he is a smart person. And he read those poll results from Massachusetts. And I suspect you'll find out before the end of the year he will have moved from the left to the center. So that's what I see happening. But now here's the longer-term forecast. And it involves the other deficit called the budget deficit. Let me try and help you put that into perspective for one moment. The budget deficit this year is about $1.4 trillion. The total budget deficit in the United States is currently running about $11 trillion total. That's what we've assembled. According to the Congressional Budget Office, which is supposed to be a nonpartisan branch of government that represents both houses of Congress. They do what they call scoring. If you introduce a law, what will the law do to the budget? And that's what they do. Now, you presume that with the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress that they would be friendlier to that perspective. So I find it interesting when the Congressional Budget Office comes out and says by the year 2020, the federal budget deficit in the United States is going to be $21 trillion. Now, let me help put that in perspective. We hear a lot of talk about your fair share. What is your fair share of the federal budget deficit? Now, I'm going to point to a distinguished gentleman right here in the front row. And your fair share, sir, family of four. What's your name, sir?
Daryl.
Terrific. I don't know why I just flashed on the Bob Newhart show. Remember Daryl, and my other brother, Daryl? Daryl, your fair share of the federal budget deficit, a standard American family, two adults, two children, right now, as of today, is $40,000 each for a total of $160,000. That's your share of the federal budget deficit. You want to write me a check? If the Congressional Budget Office is correct, and we think that they're using optimistic assumptions, your share of the federal budget deficit in 10 years will grow to $350,000. Want to write me a check? Now, that doesn't include Social Security and Medicaid. which, give or take, is another $80 trillion worth of unfunded liability. Ah, Daryl, I got a deal for you. I'll end all of your IOUs to the Federal Treasury. I need a check for $2.3 million this morning. Anybody getting nervous with these statistics? Anybody getting concerned? I think it was an interesting statistic that came out and they did a poll of the four largest political parties in the United States. Number one was the Tea Party. Number two was an independent. Number three were the Democrats, and number four were the Republicans. I wonder why. The American people are smart. They understand budget deficits. So then we went back to the Congressional Budget Office and we asked the following question. What's it going to take to get out of this mess? So, well, we can cut a deal with the Chinese. We can go to the Chinese and say, look, you have $1 trillion worth of our debt. We're going to pay you back 60 cents on the dollar. You think the Chinese are going to say yes to that? No. What if we let inflation go up by 40%? Is that the same thing as paying them back 60 cents on the dollar? Congressional Budget Office says, if you want to inflate your way out of this, we need to let inflation go at 10% for 10 years. You can inflate your way out of the budget deficit. Anybody vote for that? Nope. All right, let's tax our way out of it. Congressional Budget Office says, okay, if you really want to tax your way out, we're going to do across the board 60% tax increase now. Anyone voting for that? And when I hear people say we're going to tax our way out, I understand an interesting anomaly in the statistic. The top 1% of the population pays 40% of the taxes. The top 10% of the population pays 60% of the taxes. And the bottom 40% of the population pays no taxes. So now, sir, Daryl, I'm going to suspect you're not in the bottom 40% of the tax bracket. And I'll venture to say you're in the top 1%, but we'll just pretend you're not. Even at that level, since 40% don't pay taxes, is it $2.2 million you're going to owe or $3.4 million you owe? At some point, we've got to do something. Now, my suspicion is, you know, and many of you have heard my comment about politicians before, and I know Mr. Jobs understands this one so well, is a definition of an honest politician is once he's bought, stays bought. I got to be careful because I know Mr. Hardcastle doesn't fall in that category. So that's the reality of the budget deficit. And so I love it. The president comes out and says, well, we're going to do a budget freeze next year on 18% of the budget. And we're going to take defense off the table and we're going to take social spending off the table. I'm sorry, folks, you ain't going to solve no budget deficit problems until you put defense spending on the table and you put social programs on the table, and that includes Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They did a poll. See, I've got one of the reasons I'm optimistic about the young people of America. They did a poll of people under the age of 30 and asked them what their chances were greater of collecting Social Security or of seeing Elvis again. Elvis won the poll. Because I'm going to promise you, if you're age 28 and you see all these budget statistics coming out and you say, you know what? I don't care. They've got to cut everything. Now, those are real fighting words for a big chunk of the political lobby. And we sort of identify it as the, quote, the older folks, the AARP people. Did an interesting analysis of demographic trends. And the question was, at what point do the votes from the AARP crowd are equal to the crowd under age 40? At what point does a politician make the following cold-blooded deduction that it's better to support the views of the young instead of the old because that's my best chance for re-election? It might be a little late in the process, but about 2018 is the number. So I look at these, and now you see why I'm a little nervous in the out years. Because how do you fund those numbers in the out years? And the problem is you're going to try and borrow more money. And do you think the Chinese are interested in loaning us more money? Huh. No. You think the Europeans are going to loan us more money? They're trying to figure out how to loan money. I love the term. It's called the pigs. Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Sovereign debt is a question mark over the Europeans aren't going to loan us the money. The Chinese aren't going to loan us the money. If you can't borrow money at today's interest rate and you need to borrow money, what's going to have to happen? Come on, you all understand supply and demand. That means you're going to have to pay more money in interest rates. You're going to have to, at some point, we're going to have more inflation and more taxes. At some point in the process, we find out that interest rates are higher, that inflation is coming back, and our economy is changing. And I look at those statistics, and I look at those numbers, and I submit to you that in the out years, in the 3 to 5 year time zone, that's what I'm looking for happening. Near term, I'm terrifically aggressive. Near term, I'm bullish. Now, let me give you a few additional thoughts in the part of the process. Let me talk about biodiesel for a second. You know, we presented biodiesel and alternative energy as it's green. It'll help save the environment. Boy, do the environmentalists have a real secret for you. Try this on for size. And I got to be real careful here because I don't want to step on anybody's political beliefs or understanding. The environmental movement, you'll hear a lot more of it soon, is if you're a true environmentalist, you will become a vegetarian. Let me explain that. It's not a joke. The argument goes that what we politely call the pollutants delivered by animal husbandry, collectively of all the pigs, cows, and chickens in the world, if you were to eliminate all those animals from the world and the world of being strictly vegetarian, would have the same impact on the environment as doing away with all the automobiles. Wow. Now, so the argument is, gee, biodiesel is good for a green economy. Okay. Biodiesel is good for the economy. Okay. Biodiesel is actually a national security issue. Because OPEC, I mean, look at the reality of it. Our largest source of imported oil in the United States is from Venezuela. Does anybody think Cesar Chavez likes us? Excuse me, not Cesar. I got to be careful there. Hugo Chavez. Wow, I got to be careful. Hugo Chavez likes us. Got to be careful. Does anybody really think the Saudis are interested in our best well-being? Okay, so it's a national security issue. How about this one for a novel change? It's a budget deficit issue. It's a trade deficit issue. It's an American economic well-being issue. Because if we can hit the 25-25 goal, which is 25% alternative energy in 25 years, have we taken $150 to $200 billion out of the budget, out of the trade deficit? And you're saying, well, why is the trade deficit so important in relationship to the budget deficit? It's real simple. The trade deficit and the budget deficit control the value of the American dollar. The weaker the American dollar, the higher interest rates. The weaker the American dollar, the higher inflation rate. If you may not be able to control budget deficits, but if you can control trade deficits, you're a long way towards success. And that really is the reason why I am so positive about the long term of your industry. Because the facts are on your side. Now, great economist, John Maynard Keynes once said, and this will make a lot of sense to you in light of congressional behavior the last 6 weeks, said that the market can remain irrational far longer than I can remain solvent. Yes, it's wonderful the facts are on your side, and some of you are dealing with the insolvency issue. Let me sum it up. Am I positive near term? Yes. Stock market? I can only put it this way. I am fully invested personally. That might tell you what I think about the stock market. Now, quick word about the stock market. Historically, the stock market, from 1950 to 1966, we went straight up. From 66 to 82, we went sideways. 700,000. From 82 to 2000, we went straight up, and now we've been bouncing between 7,000 and 14,000, 7,000 and 14,000. I think long-term we could possibly get back to 14,000, followed by the disastrous headlines that are coming. I'm out of time. You've been a terrific group, a terrific audience. Let me give you a closing thought, a closing piece of investment advice. Will Rogers. Will Rogers said, buy a stock, and when it goes up, sell it. And if it don't go up, don't buy it. Good day.